We're going to talk about a subject that I don't think is covered very much, not covered very well in the media, and I think it's something that's going to become increasingly a where-you-live kind of issue, and that is how climate change affects our health, all of our health. I should tell you at the outset that one of our panelists was taken ill on the way to the to the airport yesterday and had to go back home and won't be here, and that's Lou Ziska. So I apologize for that. It does happen sometimes at these conferences. I do think we have two really excellent panelists here today, and I'll tell you a little bit about them. Leslie Fields has been working in the environmental justice arena for about two decades now. She's also pretty hip to what's going on sort of around the world and also with communities of color in our country. And she will be talking about what's going to be obviously we're all here. We want to get story ideas and sources, and so she will be providing that. We're really lucky to have Jonathan Patz here as well. We're really lucky to have both these folks here. Jonathan is the he's with the University of Wisconsin, but he has like major credentials. I was so surprised to find this guy here. He's right here in town. Thank you very much. he was the convening lead author for the United Nations World Bank Millennium Assessment. If you all are familiar with that, that's the big what the hell are we going to do report that came out 2 years ago, I think, something like that, overarching report. He's also co-chaired the Health Expert Panel for the U.S. National Assessment on Climate Change. And he's also he does writing with the IPCC. So he knows quite a bit about health effects of climate change. Fortunately, Jonathan is well acquainted with Lou Ziska, has been on panels with him. And so he's gonna go a little longer than we talked about in his talk, and he's gonna try and convey what Lou would have said were Lou here. That's the best we can do this morning. So, and then obviously we're gonna go in. I mean, the thing we're all here for is some Q&A, some dialogue, and so we'll get to that pretty early in the session, even earlier than we would have. And I may take the moderator's prerogative and ask a few questions myself. So, with that, Jonathan, tell us what you can about climate change and human health.
Okay. Thank you, Robert. And it's a pleasure to be here, and especially in my hometown. Makes it easy. The first thing I want to say is that you should all know that there's a big difference between climate and weather, and that what the biggest impression that people have is the climate that they're experiencing on that day, and today is very cold, and so it's hard to talk about global warming on a cold day. And I think climatologists are always cautioning us to make sure that we convey that climate change is about trends and where we are heading. Actually, we have changes in climate variability, so, you know, spikier type of weather, you know, more heat waves, and cold snaps, but that's an important distinction between weather and climate. So the climatologists now from the IPCC's latest assessment report are 90% certain that we have climate change and it is human-induced. So the next question is, so what? You know, what does that mean for human society? And, of course, we focus on many different areas of impacts, be they water quality, agricultural sustainability, lots of things. And I focus on public health effects, how it affects our actual health. The first thing that I'd point out, of course, that our health depends on adequate food and water supplies, and so that public health is really dependent on all of these other impact areas, and I think it's one of the integrating issues, so that we do need to be thinking about all of the impacts when you think about health. So I want to just point out one of the most important health perspectives on climate change is that we are no longer dealing with a single agent or single pathogen type of exposure, a single chemical toxin or single biological agent and looking for the cure or vaccine. Climate change will affect public health through a broad array of pathways, and that's why it's extremely important to understand the breadth of the issue, because many times I am in debates with people and they say, look, you know, are you telling me that to fight malaria it's more effective to drive less SUVs than to start a bed nets program in Ethiopia?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would say absolutely, start on the ground, but I'm not comparing the effect of climate change on a single disease compared to conventional practices, that you really need to look at climate change as a broad-reaching exposure that will affect, cut across many different parts of the health sector. So what are the impacts? You guys, I know that you know what the impacts are, and I'll just sort of quickly, very quickly, list them. You know, we know that some of the direct effects of heat waves are significant. We already have people dying in heat waves. The European heat wave in 2003 killed over 50,000 people in less than 11 days, and that's a public health disaster. Our own heat wave here in Chicago, 700 people died. We know that heat kills. Air pollution, especially ground-level smog ozone, the ground-level ozone, not the good stratospheric, but the ground-level ozone photochemical smog, many communities already are not reaching EPA standards. They're in non-attainment. And we, of course, are improving in air pollution around the country, and from the Clean Air Act, we have very good air quality, except ozone air pollution is one of the stubborn ones that is still in non-attainment in many areas. That happens to be the most temperature-sensitive air pollutant. So my colleague at the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment, SAGE, Tracy Holloway, is studying, modeling future climate effects on ozone, and it doesn't look pretty. Infectious diseases, especially infectious diseases that are indirectly transmitted. In other words, cold viruses, someone coughs on you, the cold virus goes from one 98.6 body to another 98.6 body. There's not a lot of climate interaction there. But when you deal with insect-borne diseases like malaria, dengue fever, West Nile virus, lacrosse encephalitis, any kind of vector-borne disease carried by mosquitoes or ticks, these are cold-blooded insects. They're highly sensitive to a little shift in climate. So when we think about weather in Wisconsin, in the summertime we're up in the 90s, in the wintertime it's below zero, people then ask, what's 1 or 2 degrees difference? Who cares? If you're a cold-blooded mosquito carrying the malaria parasite that kills almost 2 million people a year, mostly children, 1 degree centigrade can mean a world of difference as far as transmission dynamics. So a little bit of temperature shift in these vector-borne infectious diseases are of concern, and we're worried that some of these diseases will shift around the globe and change in intensity. I mentioned malnutrition in the IPCC. In every report, and especially in the latest report, the health sector put malnutrition as one of the top issues. We already have over 800 million people that are food insecure. A recent study in Science out of Stanford showed that number may double by the middle of the century because of extreme hot temperatures and crop failures. So malnutrition is a huge public health concern. Another issue, climate change, it's not just global warming. It's not just temperature. It's also extremes of the hydrologic cycle, of the water cycle. So more floods and more droughts. So we're talking about more droughts and malnutrition. But what about more flooding? Because hot air holds more moisture. So when it rains, it can rain really hard. Well, today in the United States, we have a pretty good water infrastructure. I think it's one of the better ones. I won't say the best, but one of the better ones in the world. And yet, even today, with our current runoff and heavy rainfall, We have over a trillion gallons of sewage-contaminated stormwater that overflow into surface waters every year in the United States. So over a trillion gallons of sewage-contaminated water. We're not handling stormwater very well right now. Well, guess what? The IPCC projects, and the newer models are reinforcing these projections, it's these very heavy rainfall events that are going to be increasing. So as far as the characteristic of rainfall, you know, not more drizzling or less drizzling rainfall or medium rainfall, it's these heavy rainfall events that are projected to increase. So that would be a threat to our water safety. So I'm going to pretend, where's my Lou Ziska hat now?
There you go.
I've talked about water. And I've talked about air pollution, and I'm a little bit taller now. I don't think he's got a beard. Not last time I saw him. So, hi, Robert. Good to meet you.
Thanks, Lou. Thanks for coming.
So, I know you've heard.
I will interrupt right here to tell you that I know some people came in late. Lou Ziska was taken ill on his way to the airport. Lou is with Agricultural Research Service. Has done a lot of pioneering work on how climate change is going to affect plants and how that would affect our health. And so, Jonathan is acquainted with his work, and I asked him to, and he's bravely standing in. So
okay. So what Lou probably came down with was severe allergies. This is October is a peak for ragweed pollen. And I'll tell you that, I mentioned air pollution, ground-level photochemical smog pollution. Ozone is temperature-sensitive. But aeroallergens are another air quality problem that we're concerned about. And what Dr. Ziska has done, he's done pioneering work simulating climate change and looking at the effects of ragweed pollen. And what he did was he set up a transect. He potted ragweed plants across a transect in Baltimore, Maryland. And so he had pots on top of the Science Center right in downtown Baltimore, where there's more pollution and more traffic, and the urban heat island effect, you know, with all the asphalt and concrete. So it's warmer. There's more CO2 in the air right downtown. He also potted plants a little bit further out in the suburbs, you know, a little bit less pollution, a little cooler, and then he potted plants out, you know, in some park away from the town. And what he found was, as expected, you know, more CO2 in the city and trending downward as you go out, hotter temperatures in the city trending downward, and he had extremely well-controlled experiments, you know, as far as watering these plants and how they're taken care of, and he had weather monitors at each place. And what he found was that the ragweed plants exposed to more CO2 and warmer temperatures produced a lot more ragweed pollen. And so these studies have been replicated in other places. And so the big concern is that from Lou Ziska's work and others is that ragweed pollen and other allergens may disproportionately increase. Now, it gets tricky, and this is where I go beyond my expertise because I'm not a botanist. But, you know, there are a lot of plants that respond differently. They're the C3s and C4s. And don't ask me about it. Ask Lou. But basically, a lot of the weedy plants, like ragweed, like poison ivy, these plants do very well with higher CO2 in the atmosphere. So there's one other concern as far as a health effect would be some of these aeroallergens. Another air quality biological issue, of course, is mold and fungus if you're dealing with floodwaters. So I remember, I won't go further than that. So I think basically Lou did some really good pioneering work simulating what climate change might mean for aeroallergens, especially ragweed pollen. So I just want to wrap up. I'll go back to myself here now. Thank you, Lou.
Thanks, Lou.
And just say that as we look at these health issues and we try to quantify them and see how large they are, I think because of the multiple exposure pathways that this is an enormous public health issue. But when we think about the challenge of climate change, and we're talking about, you know, getting ready for it, adapting to it, but also trying to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions and reduce climate change altogether, to be honest with you, I think fighting climate change could be an enormous public health opportunity, you know, greater than we've ever had in the last century. Because when you think about the co-benefits that could be had, the health co-benefits from reducing greenhouse gases, they are tremendous. And I'll just mention three issues that are being studied right now and should be coming out in the journal Lancet right before the Copenhagen meeting. One is power generation. Majority of our electricity is made by coal-fired power plants that produce a lot of particulate air pollution, and that's the most dangerous air pollution in the world. And according to the World Health Organization, more than 800 million people die prematurely every year from air pollution. So, you know, reduce fossil fuels, you reduce conventional criteria air pollutants, especially particulates. Meat production and consumption is very fossil fuel based, very fossil fuel intensive. So if we were to reduce our meat consumption and reduce energy requirements for producing meat, we all know about the cardiovascular issues, and I won't say get rid of all meat, but if we reduce our meat consumption, there could be a tremendous cardiovascular public health co-benefit. And finally, an area that we are studying in our center is the effect of having green transportation. In the United States, we are a very sedentary population. 60% of Americans do not meet the minimum level of recommended exercise, and we're an automobile-dependent society. And 40% of our trips are really short. They're less than 2 miles. So if we were to green our cities, make them have multimodal transportation, and get people out of the cars, onto their feet, or onto their feet and then the bus, or on a bicycle, there'd be tremendous health benefits. And we've got numbers, we're quantifying what that would mean if you take a certain percent of cars off the road, what would it mean for air pollution and reduced mortality from air pollution, as well as potential increased exercise and benefits. So I think that's a huge issue, this co-benefits area. And lastly, to lead into our next speaker, I'll just mention that these impacts are not happening uniformly around the world. And we produced a paper in 2007. The graphic has seen a lot of attention. It's a cartogram. It's a data-driven map that shows, you know, how the poor countries have so many climate-sensitive diseases, malaria and malnutrition and diarrheal disease, and they sort of blow up as far as how they're going to be affected by climate change. And then when you see who's causing climate change, who's causing the problem, you see Africa and India shrink down and America, you know, blowing up like we are causing the problem and other people are suffering. And so there is a huge environmental injustice issue wrapped around climate change. But that's not to say that we should be complacent in the U.S. to say, oh, the poor countries are going to get nailed yet again and we'll be immune, because we are in a globalized world. And we die in heat waves, all these other issues I mentioned, we're sensitive to them. But disease increasing anywhere in the world can affect any country in this globalized world. So. But there are imbalances. So with that, I'll stop.
Okay. And I should mention on that point that you did in this room yesterday, where there was a panel where people talked about posited the idea that perhaps the countries that will suffer the greatest are the very poor, because they're already right on the edge, and the very rich, because our lifestyle is so carbon intensive. I introduced Leslie earlier, but I realize now that I neglected to tell you sort of where she's hanging her hat. She is the National Environmental Justice and Community Partnerships Director for the Sierra Club, and I think she's going to give us some perspectives, both domestic and international. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Can you hear me? Okay, great. Good morning. And thank you, Robert, for inviting me Thank you all for having this conference and the organizers. And I've wanted to come to this conference for a really long time because I'm really dying to find, you know, just listening in the hall, how do journalists think? How do they come up with these stories? Where are they getting their information from? So I'm getting some great insights, and I appreciate being here. As Robert mentioned, I'm the National Environmental Justice and Community Partnerships Director for the Sierra Club. I'm based in Washington, D.C. We have a program I want to briefly describe that's around the country. We are in Washington, D.C. We work on the issues of the Anacostia River. We are in Memphis. We are in Detroit, which is one of the largest border crossings. A lot of attention is paid on the southern border, but there's an enormous amount of industrial activity still in Detroit, affecting Detroit, particularly around the truck traffic. 3 million trucks a year cross the Ambassador Bridge into the 408-217 community, which we work in. That's 10,000 trucks a day. Thank you, NAFTA. And they're building another bridge. And there's many, many other issues in Detroit. We are on the Navajo Nation in Flagstaff, and we also work with the Hopis and other tribal groups. We are in New Orleans working on sustainable redevelopment after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. We originally started there in 2000. That was our first project, working on the issues many of you know about Cancer Alley with the communities there, the 50 miles between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, the petrochemical refinery and chemical polyvinyl capital of the world. We still work there and with the Homa Nation. We are in Puerto Rico now. We have a 1,000-member chapter in Puerto Rico. It's just blown up. It's fabulous. And I'm like, oh, darn, I had to go to Puerto Rico. There's some amazing water issues down there in Puerto Rico, and we are also trying to preserve the Northeast Corridor, which is where the leatherback turtles come to nest. And we have a wonderful youth program there as well. I have some materials in the back if you want to take some of our propaganda. We are also working in Appalachia on the scourge, the pernicious practice of mountaintop removal, which I know many of you are familiar with. And there's a movie that we are a big part of called Coal Country, and there's been a number of premieres, and I hope you all get to see that. A lot of the information is on our website. And we're in Minneapolis, and we're working on many industrial issues there. Our Minneapolis, Washington, D.C., and New Orleans organizers and our allies are really on the front line of what I call the vanguard of the green livelihoods work that we do at the Sierra Club. And it's very, very exciting, the work that we're doing there. And I'm just very proud of this program. I'm also, and as the national director, I'm in D.C., as I mentioned, and what I would do is elevate the issues from our projects and with the larger national environmental justice community to the national level, international level. And so I work very closely with many, many national environmental justice groups on the issue of climate justice, and also with the Global South groups. Many of you know that there is a meeting in Bangkok right now. The Climate Justice Now Coalition and the Global South groups are getting themselves together for Copenhagen, and unfortunately I'm here. Not that I'd rather not be in Bangkok, but we're all over. There's a great deal of coalitional work between what we call the Global South and the Global North and the Global South and the Global South groups. We originally met, Mavis met with them in 2001 at the UN Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa. Then we met with them, we got to know them even better at the World Conference on Sustainable Development in Johannesburg in 2004. So we have kept these relationships, and they inform our work. Again, there's a number of climate justice groups now in the United States. There's the Environmental Justice Climate Change Initiative, and I'm going to quote that I'm kind of a advisor to. They put out this report, A Climate of Change, African Americans, Global Warming, and a Just Climate Policy last year. You can find it on EJCC.org. There's the Environmental Justice Forum on Climate Change out of West Harlem Environmental Action, WEAC, which is a great EJ group many of you know from Harlem. And there are a number of groups around the country fighting and working on this issue and providing solutions from the ground. And what I want to focus on in terms of health and climate are some of the impacts that are directly related to African Americans. That doesn't necessarily mean no one else is affected. That doesn't mean we don't work with other groups. But we believe with the EJCC in this report, African Americans Global Warming and a Just Climate Policy, that the climate policies that best serve African Americans can best serve climate policy for everybody. because of some of the data points that I'm going to talk about. And many of you know this, I know. But since African Americans are 13% of the U.S. population and on average emit nearly 20% less greenhouse gases than non-Hispanic whites per capita, which is correlated to what we just heard about the people least responsible having the most impacts on climate change. We have that here domestically. African Americans take more transit than non-Hispanic whites. But we have fewer cars. We have smaller houses. And the impact, the footprint is smaller, yet we are being exposed to more of the health threats. And African Americans are soon to be more vulnerable to the health effects than non-Hispanic whites in terms of health, housing, economic well-being, and are definitely more impacted when it comes to culture and social instability from such natural disasters, such as floods, such as hurricanes. Everyone talks about Katrina and Rita. Well, last year we had Ike, and Ike devastated Galveston. Galveston is still devastated. A number of Katrina people who evacuated moved to the Houston-Galveston area and have been hit twice now. Three times, because you had Katrina, you had Rita, and then you had Ike last year. Wow. We have heard very, very little about Ike, and African Americans are more vulnerable to high energy bills, unemployment, and recessions caused by global energy price shocks, which we're not going to really talk too much about. So that's why we believe the climate policies that best serve African Americans best serve a just climate policy for everybody. The six states, African Americans are at greater risk from climate change and global warming co-pollutants. And the six states with the highest African American populations are all in the Atlantic hurricane zone, are still in the deep south. It's like we never moved anywhere. We're still down there. And global warming is expected to increase the frequency and intensity of heat waves and extreme heat events. My uncle lived in Chicago. He passed away 2 years ago. He suffered greatly from that heat wave in 1995. He had to go into the hospital because we have asthma in my family. My nephews have asthma. We have very high allergies in my family, and he was hospitalized after that heat wave. This is not an abstract concept for our community. 71% of African Americans live in counties in violation of federal air pollution standards as compared to 58% of the white population. 78% of African Americans live within 30 miles of a coal-fired power plant as compared to 56% of non-Hispanic whites. Asthma has strong associations with air pollution, and African Americans have a 36% higher incidence of asthma than whites. Asthma is three times more likely to lead to emergency room visits or deaths for African Americans. We African Americans are economically more vulnerable to disasters and illnesses, as I mentioned, in the absence of insurance, in the absence of due to segregation, due to racial stereotypes that have reduced aid donations. We heard what happened after Katrina and how aid was not given to certain areas, particularly Mississippi, because there was just no history of going to Red Cross going into some counties. And so, as I mentioned, you know, there's the economic issues. One of the biggest, there's more death and injury, spread of vector-borne diseases. In Washington now, we have mosquitoes till November. Okay, I take my, you know, I live on Capitol Hill. I love it. And I can walk everywhere. It's wonderful. It's a blessing. I can walk to work. And I worked very hard to be able to walk to work. But we have alleys. We have this, you know, like in Chicago, we have alleys. And I go out and took my garbage to the alley where they pick it up. And there's still mosquitoes out there. It doesn't get cooler at night. It was 75, excuse me, when I left Washington yesterday. And it's about going to be 78 today, I think. And it's, you know, middle of October. Also, changes in food quality and availability also impact excessively on African Americans. Another big issue, which I really hope there will be some more ink on, is the issue of mental health and climate change. I've seen very, very little on this. Most of the research that I've found on basically just the stress of climate change, I use stress to speak to people who understand stress. When you say mental health, it kind of people will like step back from that. There's been a lot. The Australians have done a lot of research on this. And the international, I have the site here, really good studies on, I'll find in a minute. But the immediate mental health impacts of climate change domestically and internationally are very profound. They cut across gender. Women are also disproportionately impacted and special impacts on women. You can just imagine what they are, and you guys can go investigate what they are, because this area really needs to get fleshed out, I think, and also the impacts on children. Children, as you know, are not little small adults. Their systems are growing, their immune systems are growing, and when they're stressed out, because their parents are stressed out, because now they're homeless due to maybe a flood or a natural disaster, the impacts on children, short-term and long-term. I think that getting back to the impacts, there's just been a few studies done on the mental health impacts from our biggest event everyone likes to talk about, so go back and talk to Katrina. There has been really high rates of depression, domestic violence, and significantly higher rates of suicide completion and attempts, which is also something that there's a difference between just killing yourself and then trying to kill yourself and why you're trying to kill yourself. And high rates of post-traumatic stress disorder. You also see this internationally. I mean, the backstory to many conflicts in, as you know, internationally, migration is climate. We saw that. We've seen that in Sudan. I'm on the board of an organization called Horn Relief, and it is a Somali environment and women's development organization. We're based in Nairobi. I was in Kenya most of March, and one of the main issues as earlier discussed, is the issue of vector-borne diseases. And now in Kenya, they are really suffering because of the there used to be just mosquito-borne diseases, mostly in the low area near Mombasa. Now it's all, the mosquitoes are in the highlands. They're up near Lake Victoria. They're up in Kisumu. What was so great about going to Kenya was that everybody, I got to take the paper bag off my head, and people asked me, "Are you an American?" And I said, "Yes." And they would come up to me and embrace me and say, "Thank you for voting for Obama." And it was just wonderful. And they're actually, his father was from a town called Kisumu, which is up near in the highlands in Lake Victoria, and they're building basically Obama land up there for when President Obama does get around to going there. So they're building an airstrip. They're building all this stuff for, you know, to build this big tourist area, and they're having trouble because people are falling over from malaria, which they've never seen before, and in such numbers. So in terms of economic development issues, it's really impacting, and as you know, malaria is one of the greatest causes of morbidity for young children in that region. So it's a huge issue that is not just stressing people out, it's decreased, you know, it's affecting the economic development of these regions, and also, you know, because it's a public health issue. And caring for the mental health needs of people is just, it's just not, we don't have a good infrastructure here. Most countries don't have their good infrastructures. And we're going to see more and more often that the mental health impacts on climate change, I think, is really going to grow. It's less easy to quantify, but there are studies that are tracking, there are public health schools that are tracking this. There's also, I think there's a fantastic study going on at Columbia University, the Mellon School of Health, Public Health. They are they have a cohort of pregnant African American and Latino women, and they're assigning them little air monitors on their backs. And so these women are going about their daily business, getting on the bus, being exposed to the ground level soot and the ground level ozone that you described. And they are they have these little packs on their backs, and these little air monitors that are taking the air samples from going from their house to the South Bronx to maybe to work in Manhattan, back to the store, and they're getting this information, and they're able to, you know, and then they're going to see, they're going to track the babies as they're born for their first year. I think this is a fascinating study about public health, women's health, and also children's health.
But let me interrupt there, because I want to ask I guess I want to ask both of you this. We've talked a lot about ozone, but I don't think we've talked about how climate change will make the ozone problem worse. Could you explain the how that would happen? Either of you.
Yeah. Well, it's all a matter of.
Can you hear back there?
So first, of course, you have to think about what will the emissions be. So, given the same emission, you know, keeping emissions constant. Ozone is a secondary air pollutant. In other words, it doesn't come directly out of a tailpipe or a smokestack. There are precursor elements, so volatile organic compounds like unburned gasoline and things that fumes that go up into the air, mixing with nitrogen oxides that come out of your tailpipe, that's a mixture that happens in the atmosphere, and it's a chemical reaction driven by sunlight and by temperature. Mm-hmm. So at higher temperature, you get more ozone formation. And so there are people that are modeling, you know, what would it mean if you had higher temperatures? We've done studies, and this one study that shows in the eastern United States that climate change, the temperature rise from climate change alone, could increase the number of red ozone alert days by 68%. Not even thinking about the fact that with heat waves you get more stagnant air masses. So forgetting about more stagnant air masses, that would make it even worse. Just looking at the temperature alone in that chemical reaction for this secondary air pollutant, your ozone would be increasing. Now, hopefully we'll have reduced emissions, so that won't, you know. But
under this, the woman who Leslie was talking about, whatever the findings are, now the point is that if we don't reduce emissions, those impacts are going to increase.
Right. And, you know, to another generation. I mean, these fetuses are being exposed to this, you know, as they are growing in their mother's uterus. So, you know, they're being born compromised.
Yeah.
Their health is compromised.
I have a couple of questions myself, but we've run kind of over. So I'm going to go to the audience, and if you guys run out of questions, I have plenty. There's a couple things I need to tell you here. First of all, we ask that SCJ members go first and working journalists after that. If we still have time, then we'll get to others in the room. We want you to ask a question and not make a speech. If you do anything wrong, I'll get out the whip and the chair. So, okay, go ahead.
You talked a little
bit. Oh, and I'd like for you to identify yourself as well and your news organization.
David Steinkraus from the Journal Times in Wisconsin. You talked a lot about the effect on African Americans, but ancestry care always did that.
Well, excuse me, this is an interesting issue, and it's a good question, because in terms of healthcare delivery systems, that is debate going on as we speak. And in many parts of the country, such as the Gulf, as you all know, I mean, in the Times-Picayune, maybe some of the people are here, you know, they got a Pulitzer for the reporting after they were also displaced after Katrina and Rita. Charities closed in New Orleans. LSU is operating as a clinic. Tulane is operating as a clinic. Oshman is the only hospital/clinic in New Orleans, in the region. All right, they lost three major health facilities. In D.C., D.C. General has been closed. In Chicago, Cook County was closed. In L.A., Drew King was closed. These are the big municipal county, city hospitals, all right? This has been going on for now a number of years. So
why are they closing them?
They're dying. I mean, they're financial reasons.
I mean, because
of the number of Medicaid, Medicare, you know, because of these populations that are not served anywhere else. Everyone's going to the emergency rooms. I mean, this is the whole healthcare debate we're discussing now nationally. Right. So the this is, again, the panel yesterday was talking about all these threats, you know, these are threat multipliers, okay? In the national security discussion yesterday, they talked about the national security threats and the threat of migration and other populations and competition, but these are also threat multipliers in our society because you can't go, if you've ever been to the emergency room, I'm sure you have, you know how long you have to wait because somebody is having an asthma attack and has to be seen first. So if someone's gotten shot and they have to be seen first, or someone doesn't have to write paperwork, or the English isn't their first language, or all these things. So these are all threat multipliers, and we have seen our healthcare delivery system crater generally. So when it comes to these issues of climate and public health and climate, it's just another threat multiplier.
Okay. Elsa?
I'm Elsa Setsu, I'm a freelance journalist in Los Angeles, public radio. I know you follow the African American community. Mm-hmm.
No, I'm not. I'm just saying that was in the time frame. You know, one is very tied to there. Much of the, we were going to do another report that said climate of change, Hispanic Americans, and global warming and just kind of policy. But, of course, we ran out of money. Okay? And so merry money are the same of the issues. And, of course, you have the issues, the rural issues of climate and heat with farm workers and who are really suffering because of you're seeing major, huge, long-standing heat events. Thank you. And they're not the only farm workers, but there's a high proportion of farm workers that are Hispanic. So, yes, they're exposed a great degree. And also the economic displacement when you have to – the energy price shocks, when you have to decide, well, we got to pay the – you know, we're trying to pay the energy bill. We have to feed the kids because the energy bills are rising. And so this is – this whole debate is seething right now on Capitol Hill because how are we going to get – you know, how are we going to have the allowances if we're going to have 15% or whatever percent allowances for, what is it called now, carry boxer going to the public good? How is that going to get offset for low-income, middle-income people? Are there going to be rebates? Are there going to be tax credits and that sort of thing?
I want to clarify that. So yeah. You're saying that the carry boxer it envisions higher costs being offset by
they're working on tax credits and there's a whole
with the presumption that energy prices are going to go up.
Yeah,
I see.
Yeah,
and so they would do it to the income.
Right,
income
but there's
tax.
Going you know there's a whole provision on offsets.
Yes.
All right, and the utilities and all of that. So they say you know it's supposed to work out, but there are we have seen price shocks in different parts of the country depending on what's going on, and the economic displacement when there is again another heavy rain event like you saw in Georgia. All right, there was a drought. And then, if some of you from Atlanta know, it rained, and there's a huge, huge flooding event. Okay, and people have lost their property. They're sitting in contaminated water. They are staying in shelters. I mean, this again is the mental health piece. All right, the stress from these severe climate events, where the parts of the world that are getting wetter are getting wetter, and parts of the world are getting drier. So we have this. The point is. What's interesting is to me is that there's such a disconnect I see in the press between what's happening internationally in climate and then what happens here domestically. It's so much of the same thing with so many of the same kinds of populations. And the Hispanic population, yes, is very severely impacted, to much to the same degree as the African American population. And they contribute less as well. I mean, you're the ones you see in suburban Virginia riding their bikes, walking. They're walking and taking the bus.
Right.
So they contribute much less to greenhouse gas emissions. But as we go into a carbon-constrained economy, we have to figure out a way to make sure that these costs and these effects in the healthcare delivery systems, you know, are going to the distinct populations who are most affected. And that's been the tricky part.
And we're trying to take 3 buses to work in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
It stresses you out.
Yeah.
Yeah, big time. I mean, this is the Bus Riders Union, as you know, in Los Angeles, works on this, the Labor Strategy Center, which is a fantastic group. There's a whole Just Transportation Policy Coalition, which is based in out of their shop. It's busridersunion.org. And they have been to court to show the disproportionate discriminatory effects of transportation policy. Who is getting, you know, the train to the suburbs, how much subsidies are going out to the suburbs as opposed to what's going into the cities, and how bad the buses are,
wow.
And then raising the bus fares for students, you know, as a way to get revenue, and these are the students that need to get to school, and so that's, and again, if we have a fair transportation policy where we flip the switch between, right now, the reauthorization has the revenues going 80% to highways and 20% to transit, if we flipped it to 80% to transit and 20% to highways, we would have people, you know, it would change really the dynamic of our country.
Okay, next question in the front here.
So, Dr. Pat, with respect to, I'm Cassandra Woolier, and I'm a freelancer in Brooklyn, New York. So, with respect to infectious diseases, there's been a lot of kind of trends happening over the past 50 years. So, do you think something like climate change is substantially different or more important than things like globalization?
Did you all hear the question?
Yes.
The question was about to what degree some of these trends in infectious diseases are driven by climate versus other factors.
So that is a great question. It's a difficult question, and in fact, possibly an unanswerable question. You know, I mentioned that a lot of these infectious diseases, especially insect-borne diseases, are extremely sensitive to temperature. You have to have a certain envelope of temperature, or you can't have certain diseases. The malaria parasite will not develop inside the mosquito below a certain temperature, like 15 degrees centigrade for falciparum and 18 degrees or so for vivax malaria. These parasites cannot develop. That's why malaria is a tropical disease. So you must have adequate climate for these diseases to exist. The question is, has the increasing trend in infectious diseases, emerging diseases around the world, how much of that is related to climate change? Is, I think, an answer that is a question that we cannot answer. It is very hard to disentangle long-term climate shifts in climate and hold constant disease reporting, bed net programs, vector control, human population migration, drug resistance of the parasites. All of these are happening concomitantly. And so to be able to say climate change has done, this much is attributable to climate change is very difficult. Now, the World Health Organization tried to at least say, you know, what diseases can we at least put on the map and say we understand a link between temperature and disease incidence. Let's see if we can come up with some numbers. And so they've done at least a first start where they said, how much has climate changed in the last 30 years? And they come up, the amount of emissions, I think about a third or half a degree centigrade temperature rise globally. They pick malaria, diarrheal disease, malnutrition, and flooding, and came up with some numbers. And those are a first start. The way we're dealing with this is we're taking what we call analog studies, like El Nino gives us unseasonably warm or wet or dry temperature climate, depending where you are. It's just abnormal, very intense shift in climate. And we look at what has disease done in these areas where we've had very extreme climate. So, for example, the El Nino of 1997, one of the strongest we've had, in eastern Africa, in the Rift Valley region, they had 60 times the normal amount of rainfall that they usually have. And what happened, not surprisingly, was a Rift Valley fever epidemic. You know, this is a mosquito-borne virus, very serious disease. And we have a lot of these stories around the world to show how climate-sensitive many of these diseases are. So,
did you say they got 60 times as much rain as they normally do?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
It's a combination of El Nino and a warm Indian Ocean, sort of beyond my expertise, but the climatologists. So it's really a matter of we look at where you get extreme fluctuation in climate, and we study what happens to disease at those locations, and we find, in general, that those extremes can affect disease. Now, I can't, this is where, because it's so entangled, climate effects with all the other socioeconomic and environmental change issues, that it really is a hard question to answer. And I would argue that even, deforestation, affects local climate more quickly and more drastically than long-term climate change.
I wanted you to also clarify something you said earlier. You said that a 1 degree difference could make a big change. Could make a big difference. 1 degree change could make a big difference for malaria. Two questions: is it centigrade or Fahrenheit? And to explain the mechanism. I mean, you're talking about averages. Is what you're what we're getting at, right?
Yes. So 1 degree centigrade, and you're dealing with a biological system where you have the parasite develops in the mosquito. Crosses the stomach lining of the mosquito and develops into an infective stage in the salivary glands. That's a temperature-dependent development time.
And so would 1 degree difference, expand? I mean, you would expect to see it going further into the non-tropical areas, or?
Well, as always, it's pretty complicated. So you have issues. You have a mosquito, a parasite, and a person. You have to think about how many mosquitoes there are, the biting rates of mosquitoes, the development time of the parasite, the survival of the mosquitoes. Some people look at these issues and they say, well, in the laboratory, the mosquito that carries yellow fever and dengue virus, in the laboratory, it dies when it gets too hot. And so how is it going to transmit disease? The bad news is there's not a single single research paper that shows Aedes aegypti mosquito actually declining in population in the wild, because mosquitoes adapt. You know, they fly down in the drains. They fly under. They look for their microclimate. So there, it's a very but in general, we're looking at the development time of the parasite, which is an exponential term in this equation. But it's not straightforward. You know, you have to look at all these other factors.
I'm sorry. Can I just ask? I wanted to. This is what I just remembered about this lady's question. A sister group to the Commission to Engage African Americans on Climate Change is the National Latino Climate Change Coalition, which is NLCCC.org. And I've presented a number of their panels, and they just did a big workshop in Albuquerque. So they're going around the country, and they've been formed by the Bipartisan Coalition, which got money from the Hewlett Foundation to start these groups. So it's NLCCC.org, and they're doing great work, and we work very closely with them. Roger Rivera is their director.
I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, sorry, I slipped my mind.
Fine.
Yeah.
Yes, next question.
Hi, I'm Laura Sloan with the University of Vermont. Mm-hmm.
We could never decide it.
Just the question. You guys have the question. The question is how Sierra is, how they're splitting their efforts between adaptation and fighting greenhouse gases. And it sounds like they're going crazy.
Yeah, we are. It's okay. It's all good. It's a very good question. And, we've worked with Oxfam, and I'm really glad they did that. They have a great coalition on this. And much of the work that we do is adaptation work. It's like much of the work we do is faith-based. We just don't proselytize it. We work out of – half of my offices are out of churches. Mm. Like the Mary Queen of Vietnam Parish, the second largest Vietnamese parish in New Orleans, and Holy Cross Neighborhood Association in Lower Ninth Ward. That's where we work out of. So it's the same thing. The adaptation is incredibly important, and adaptation means different things to different people. We are not necessarily going to get – we are working on – with the Environment and Public Works Committee on more robust adaptation language in the domestic part. I think it's Title III of Carrie Boxer. There's actually, again, more attention to the international piece than the domestic piece. But we can also work it through, for example, there's the Gulf Coast Civil Works Bill, which has a, hopefully, if that passes, again, is part of the sustainable reconstruction of the Gulf Coast and to include more infrastructure, more health delivery systems. If we ever get a new transportation bill instead of just reauthorizing, doing continuing resolutions, again, the transportation piece is adaptation in terms of particularly not just the urban areas of our country but the rural areas of the country who desperately need transportation options. So the adaptation part is not necessarily going to come out of Boxer Carry, but is also going to come in other legislation. And also with the rulemaking that we're doing, it's become very robust. For 8 years I was filing petitions for rulemaking against the wall and watching them slide off at EPA. And now they're sticking. And Administrator Jackson is accepting our petitions for rulemaking, and all of a sudden, oh my God, we have to execute.
We're a lot of practice now.
Well, we got it. Yeah, and it's very, very exciting. And that's a whole. That is actually as important as the legislative part, because we can get public participation, we can get the other voices, and that's the other thing I wanted to emphasize about this, is that the stories about this adaptation work and climate is coming. What's exciting to me is that we're creating new transformative allies. We are working with different kinds of people all the time. And so these are where the solutions are coming from. I think this is really something else that is very important to emphasize in this, is that the people coming forward, whether it's the elders or the kids who are getting involved, or, you know, one of the, we are, the Vietnamese community is working very hard to redevelop the Bayou Sauvage Wildlife Refuge in New Orleans. It is, many of you might know, the largest wildlife refuge, urban wildlife refuge in the United States. It has these beautiful, beautiful gangplanks and boardwalks so the disabled people can go out and enjoy birding and go out and enjoy the environment. Another population that has gotten involved because they are being denied access to parks and wildlife places and places to go where you can fish with your grandkids if you're disabled. So we're really seeing with climate, as Dr. Paps is saying, this is really the opportunities for new, you know, it's very challenging, but there's all these great new opportunities that are coming along to have these transformational allies and to come up with these solutions we're not thinking of. And Sierra Club is just, you know, we're big and we're all over the place and we can't agree all the time, but the adaptation part is really the sustainable development, green livelihoods piece. We just don't kind of call it that.
Jonathan, you had a...
Yeah, I just want to make one comment regarding this question of adaptation mitigation. I've been on the IPCC for 15 years, and this really comes out of climatology thinking, of the climatologist saying, okay, well, there's the greenhouse gas emissions causing climate change, and then there's everything else, which is downstream, and, well, things are going to happen, and we have to adapt to them. And, you know, I'm in public health, and I think it's a disservice to have this divide between mitigation and adaptation. Mm-hmm. To me, it's all a continuum, a matter of prevention. And so how far upstream do you want to be preventing? And we, in public health, we have basically primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention. And, you know, tertiary prevention is you're already sick, prevent that person from dying. Secondary is early warning. And primary is, you know, reduce exposure. And so to me, it's actually just all a continuum. And to me, mitigation, adaptation should blend together. There shouldn't be a divide. And as I mentioned, regarding co-benefits of mitigation, I think, you know, those are extremely important as far as, well, I just say, I like to blend that and just say it's all one issue of one continuum of prevention.
And just to be clear, a co-benefit would be, for instance, if we were driving less in order to prevent climate change, or not prevent, but to slow down is what we're really talking about, slow down climate change, then people would be healthier. They wouldn't be so overweight.
That's right. And, in fact, I would argue that possibly the steps we take to mitigate climate change may outweigh, the health benefit may outweigh the risks of a lot of the climate change risks.
So climate change is good for us.
No. Fighting. No, fighting climate change is good for us.
Okay.
How
so
did that go?
Identify yourself first, please. Questions about how higher latitudes, the climate change, which is proceeding much more quickly there, how that will affect health.
There's a fantastic case my dear departed friend Luke Cole brought to the Ninth Circuit, who's the Center for Race, Poverty, and Environment. He just passed away, unfortunately, a few months ago. He's been working with the folks who live on Kivalina Island in Alaska, and their ice sheet that protects their island is melting. And so the permafrost is melting, and basically that community is going to have to relocate and go over to the mainland, just as you're going to see in Tuvalu, the Maldives. You know, I mean, we're talking about the economic, social, cultural ramifications of losing your entire culture, how you'll never be able to go back and visit the graves of your grandparents. Okay, that's what that means. And again, this is the mental health part that I'm staying on, beating this drum. I don't think there's any words for that. Okay, I don't think any of us and can, you know, unless you really understand. And I think that's why it really needs to really get developed. And you know, just the fishing, their whole way of life. And we are. I'm. On November 13th, a number of Hopi elders are coming, and we're going to help them work with them and lobby in Washington, because they're going to lobby about the effects of climate change on sacred sites and what has happened to their sacred sites in Arizona. Because they're degrading because of climate change. So the cultural, we never talk about the cultural part. Just trying to talk about the global health stuff is enough. But there's a lot. The cultural part does get into the mental health part. If you start to see, you're not able to go visit the graves of your ancestors again because they're underwater, or because you can't get to the island, or because it's just not feasible, or it's dangerous, or it's just going to disappear.
And if I can just add one thing, and that is that. It's never unidirectional, and they talk about climate change will have some winners and some losers. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's an EPA study that was put out a long time ago talking about Rocky Mountain spotted fever in the southeastern United States may actually decline because the ticks won't be able to withstand the temperature. Mm-hmm. And the former Soviet Union, the agriculture, they'll have a longer growing season. I think the Canadians won't fare so well because I think it's all just, granite shields up there, and I don't think you have soil to grow anything. Well, maybe you do.
But I think they're growing some wheat in Saskatchewan last time I checked.
Okay. So anyway, except for Saskatchewan. But they're certainly,
There's also the boreal forest. Good point.
Yeah, and in fact, Lyme disease may shift up into Canada and out of the U.S. So there will be winners and losers. I'll just tell you what the IPCC conclusions are from the health sector, which is that on balance, the adverse effects are going to outweigh the beneficial ones. And so, we shouldn't be just assuming, broadly and universally that, every impact is going to be negative in every location. That would be unrealistic. But on balance, in the public health area, we're very concerned that, the concerns are much higher than some of the benefits, I think, from the climate.
Okay. Emily. Yeah, but first you have to tell us who you are. Question has to do with why people aren't recognizing the co-benefits of fighting.
I guess that's one question. I was thinking more in terms of agencies or institutions, but
I'll just say that things are shifting rapidly, and these are on the table. There are, the series of papers that's about to come out in November, and some work we're going to be putting out in the spring. A lot of people are shifting now to include counting up the co-benefits of reducing greenhouse gases, the health co-benefits. I know the federal agencies, NIH, CDC, EPA, are thinking about this. So it's rising in awareness. So.
And you mentioned that you're working on quantifying some of those benefits?
Yes. We have numbers. And
that's what's going to come out in The Lancet?
For the U.S., that's coming out in the spring.
Oh, okay.
But, we're using quantitative maps, quantitative models to look at what would it mean if you took off a certain percentage of automobile trips, commutes, replace those with bus trips or walking or biking. What would it mean for air pollution? What would it mean for exercise opportunities? And then translating that into reduced cancer, cardiovascular, diabetes deaths, things like that.
Interesting. Okay. You had a second one.
Yeah, I just wondered, how do you estimate the impact of the NAACP's resolution on fighting climate change and, encouraging new jobs development?
Which resolution?
Question has to do with NAACP.
We've been filing resolutions on this for a long time. The National Wildlife Federation got ahead of themselves and didn't do their research and announced it was a historic resolution. And I filed resolutions on environmental justice 15 years ago. I did one on climate change 5 years ago. I did one on green jobs 2 years ago. So the impact is, for this resolution, not It's another one in a series of resolutions, and it's good. And what it does is just allows the state chapters and allows the national office to go forward on those issues. Okay. So what's happened is Jim Benjelis serves with us on the Commission to Engage African Americans on Climate Change, the head of the NAACP, and they are they've gotten some funding to hire a director of climate policy. Who's cool? And her name's Jacqueline. She just started. I forget her last name. Her name is Jacqueline. And the only reason I remember that is my mother's name is Jacqueline. So it's a good thing. We've worked with NAACP, especially the Washington Bureau, Hillary Shelton. I've known Hillary for 22 years. That's where I started when I first got out of law school. So it's like any big organization, like the Sierra Club. Some are more responsive to others. One of the things that is another story that's very important to understand with NAA or an Urban League, who've been doing actually workforce development and green job, workforce development for 20 years, they're the experts on this stuff, is that what I like to say is that nothing gets taken off their plates. They're still dealing with housing, criminal justice, voting rights, all the traditional stuff, and now we are asking them, okay, now you got to do climate change with this, with no more resources. So they did manage to get some funding. All these groups, the traditional civil rights groups, the traditional aid groups, this is what Oxfam is, working with now. These traditional groups that had a traditional mandate, that's what their board has decided on. And now we have to, just like with LULAC, we were at the LULAC convention in Puerto Rico, the League of Latin American Citizens, and doing a panel for the first time on climate change and getting a resolution with LULAC for the first time on climate change. We don't make a big deal about it. And working with and taking their youth conference on an outing out to see where the turtles are in El Yunque National Park. So it's a very good thing. It's a positive thing. It's nothing new. And some chapters, like I'm most familiar with the Texas State chapter of NAA, we've been working on EJ and climate when farm worker issues, toxics, all kinds of environmental issues they've been working on for like 20 years. So again, if you haven't heard about it, write the story about it, please.
Yeah, we're getting pretty close, so we don't have too much time. In the back, tell us who you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this climate of change on the environmental justice climate change .org website, ejcc.org. There's also the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, Commission to Engage African Americans on Climate Change, that's jointcenter.org. There's the National Latino Climate Change Coalition, that's nlccc.org. And I was remiss again, there's the National Hispanic Environmental Coalition, nhec.org. I live in D.C., so all we do is rattle off acronyms and, alphabets.
Same thing for Jonathan.
Yeah.
Well, for any of the IPCC findings, it's simply ipcc.ch, and the reports for summary for policymakers. Thank you. Summary for policymakers, and there's a technical summary. These are really accessible files.
They're great.
And then, as far as the health research, you could just go to www.sage.wisc.edu, and then go into the health area.
That's sage.wisc for Wisconsin. That's the work you're doing. Mm-hmm. Are you going to be able to talk before December about any of these co-benefits, or your research is coming out in the spring? But obviously, there's a big thing happening in Copenhagen in December.
Right. Right. All I can tell you is that between the World Health Organization and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, they've been working on these studies that have now been, I think, have been accepted in the journal and are planning to come out sometime before Copenhagen.
Okay, so we'll get a look at the sort of the international picture, and then in the spring more the national picture.
I think they're
yeah. Well, let's try and squeeze in one more question here.
I just got a clarification.
Tell us who you are first.
Ah.
It requires that you put www in front of it.
Oh, really?
It does.
It didn't used to.
Wow, we're going backwards now. Damn.
Yeah, we didn't used to have to do that. Okay.
Thanks, Brett.
Well, we can squeeze in one more question. Yes, in the back. Tell us who you are, please.
I'm Laura Frank.
And let me just add also, yeah, if there's any other uncovered stories, talk about them now. The question's about whether there are data sets, and then your last thoughts about what needs more coverage on this area.
I like to try to find, your flagship university, of course, like University of Wisconsin, health school, the environmental school. What I'm trying to do in my program is link up each program to a major university. We work very closely in Detroit, for example, with the Environment and Natural Resources School at University of Michigan and the Law School and the Public Health School. So they are always a treasure trove. Like I mentioned, Columbia, many of the public health schools medical schools are great sources of information. The graduate students have the research that they do. And I just wanted to also make a pitch for, I think another untapped story is just the emerging leaders on climate justice and climate change. I can't tell you how, I'm so tired of reading about the same person being quoted all the time from NRDC. I'm tired of hearing Carl Pope being quoted from Sierra Club. I'm tired of seeing, Jonathan Lash. The same people. Come on. Go deep, okay? There's some great young emerging leaders. You're going to miss out. These people 20 years from now are going to be running the world. They'll solve the problems, and you're going to still be looking for Carl somewhere. Okay? Please.
He's so inaccessible.
I know. And he did a great job on the Parks documentary. Don't get me wrong. But really, go deep on this, because there are some great young people. There was Power Shift every year. And this pains me to say this because I used to be a young people, but they are really doing great stuff. So please search them out. Get the budding young journalists, support them as well. I know you guys all have great internship programs wherever you're affiliated with, and really because we need to step off.
Email Leslie for suggestions.
Yeah.
Jonathan.
I think EPA may have some localized type of information. If you go on to EPA websites and look under climate change, there's a global. They have a global change research program also, and then there. I think Environmental Defense Fund may have a map of environmental toxins and things like that.
The TRI, it's very good.
Yeah. So other than that, I'm not sure.
Oh, and the CDC is very good. They're really, Howard Frumkin, Dr. Frumkin, is really pushing them. There's actually a big on environmental health regarding climate change, and there's going to be a conference October 25th to 29th in Atlanta coming up on environmental health, and there's going to be a lot of talk about the impacts on climate change.
Okay.
At the CDC, and also the National Institutes for Environmental Health, obviously. They have some good stuff, too.
But one quick regarding local, following up Leslie's comment about Howie Frumkin and CDC, of course, the local health organizations are very much on
That's
board.
Right. The state.
NACHO, National Association for City and City
Health
Officials.
Right.
Nacho?
Yeah.
Nacho? It's called Nacho?
Nacho, yeah.
No, it's got two A's in it. Got two A's in it.
Mm-hmm.
Or two C's, I don't know which. Nacho. And then, so the local health officials are on board with this, and they're moving forward.
Also, the minority health associations. National Medical Association, the African American Medical Association, Hispanic, Asian, Native American. Anything from national in front of it means African American. National Bar, National Medical, National Dental. So they've got good information locally. And then there's all kinds of groups. There's the black nurses, Hispanic nurses, all these, it's as much as you could stand, really.
Okay, join me in thanking our speakers, if you would.
Thank you.